How important is the 2016 presidential election in terms of the Supreme Court? We're going to talk about that right now with a constitutional attorney. Her name is Jenna Ellis. She's written a book called The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution. Her website is jennaellis.org. I'm Jerry Newcomb for Vocal Point, and Jenna, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jerry. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, sure. So, there probably will be a major battle for the Supreme Court in the years ahead. So, how important is the presidential election, and I should add the senatorial elections, on that front?
The Supreme Court is really the key issue for November, regardless of what happens with the presidency and some of the other issues. The Supreme Court is where we're really seeing the tension and really the stripping of our fundamental rights that are taking place. And we saw that just over the past couple of weeks of decisions that were handed down by a Supreme Court that's currently missing one member and may have a couple more members retire from the court depending on the next couple of years. So for the election, particularly the presidency in November, that is the voting issue as far as I'm concerned.
How many of the members are older than 80? Do you know offhand?
I know that there are several, and there we certainly with Justice Roberts is the youngest on the court, and he's been a recent appointee. But there are several. Obviously, Justice Scalia just passed away, and so even if they don't retire, Kennedy and Ginsburg. And Thomas are getting into that age range where, you know, certainly nature could take its course or they could just simply retire depending on who is elected. And then if it's Hillary and she appoints someone who's a very young justice, they will impact American jurisprudence for the next 30 to 40 years. So we're not looking at just the next 4 to 8 years. We're looking at the next 40.
Sure. And by the way, I did read just this morning that Clarence Thomas is apparently 68, but some of the other justices are definitely older. It's an amazing thing. Okay, now, it seems to me that the left understands this is the hill to die on, and the right, some of people understand it and others don't. And when it comes to this whole issue of the battle over the justices that get appointed and then get approved onto the high court.
Right, and that's what we're really seeing. I'm actually at the Western Conservative Summit this weekend where a lot of the Republicans who are pro-Trump and others who are very never-Trump or anti-Trump are gathering to hear him speak. And, you know, he's not the perfect candidate. He's not most people's first choice. I'm not really sure that we could accurately characterize him as a constitutional conservative. But what we can categorize him is not Hillary, and certainly not doing as nearly as much damage in a lot of areas across America, but particularly the Supreme Court. He has at least released his list of potential nominees, and while certainly he's not bound to that, that was something that's never been done before by a presidential candidate actually saying,
yes,
here's the list of who I'm considering. And a lot of those were very good names. They were
yes,
were conservatives. And so, again, even though there's the argument of, well, we never should choose the lesser of the two evils, that's what a closed universe election always is. Unless we have an absolutely perfect candidate, we always choose from among the options that are given to us. That is a representative republic, and that's what we are in America. We're not a direct democracy where it's just majority vote goes. We elect our representatives who then exercise their limited powers that are delegated to them by the U.S. Constitution. And Trump is certainly better in, even if it's only one area, and that's the Supreme Court, that is a huge, huge factor, and that gets my vote.
You know, it's interesting, too, because maybe people don't realize the degree to which the Supreme Court has shaped and changed America. Let me give a Rip Van Winkle type of example. In 1965, a young man, well, actually, he was maybe in his 30s or even 40s, but Jeremiah Denton went off to serve his country when called in Vietnam. He became a prisoner of war for about 8 years. When he returned, 1973, and he was being driven from one part of Virginia to another part of Virginia. He was asking his wife, "What is that? What is that? What is that?" He saw Playboy magazine. He saw porno magazines on the racks. Those weren't around, at least, you know, in with steady, ready access for, you know, in all kinds of different places, convenient places, when he went to prison as a prisoner of war, you know, in wartime. He saw abortion clinics. I mean, all kinds of changes happened from 65 to 73. And in virtually every case, you could get right back to the U.S. Supreme Court, whether it was abortion on demand, taking away school prayer. Of course, that happened just before he left. But anyway, you see the example I'm giving?
Absolutely. And it's funny that you specifically mentioned 1965 and evidence of the sexual revolution, because one of the most critical cases in the progressive shift also occurred in 1965 with Griswold v. Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
That was a case that considered contraception. And as we saw, a fundamental worldview shift in America from understanding that truth comes from God, morality comes from God, and that our rights come from God, not the government, and that the only proper role of government is to preserve and protect those rights. And we were shifting away from understanding natural law and that God is over that into a social contract theory, which is the idea that the majority of whoever is in power, which currently is the majority of the Supreme Court, and that they can, through whatever whim of the majority happens to be on the bench, they can legislate and they can delegate morality to the rest of America. And in 1965, in that case, speaking for the majority, the justices actually said, we don't find the right to privacy, the right to contraception within the text of the Constitution, but we are literally going to read between the lines. And they created a doctrine called the penumbra doctrine, which is sounds like a fancy legal term, and it comes from a scientific word that literally means reading between the text to see what emanates from that. And in every decision that has advanced the progressive notion, they have referred back to the penumbra doctrine, to reinterpreting what the text means, to proof texting, to pulling out one or two words and building an entire progressive new meaning and new legal fiction around those terms. And so as we've seen the fundamental worldview shift, the court has been very savvy, and the liberal members, to say, we know that there really is no textual assertion or grant of power through this, but we're going to find our way around the text. And so as we've seen from 1965 to 1973 in Roe v. Wade to 2003 and the sodomy decision in Texas to last year in the same-sex marriage decision, to last week and the abortion decision in Texas in Hellerstadt, saying that the court cares more about unrestricted abortion than women's health. All of those decisions have stemmed from a usurping court that's literally reading between the lines.
Wow. All right, we're talking right now with Jenna Ellis, who's a constitutional attorney. You know, it seems to me that the liberals who produced that constitutional mess for us are not abiding by what Jefferson called in the Declaration of Independence the laws of nature and of nature's God.
They aren't, and that's where they have been so savvy to cut off the source of the Constitution's authority. In the law, when I go into court and I say, judge, you need to rule for my client this way, then the judge will say, well, counsel, what's your authority for that? And no one considers, where does the source of the U.S. Constitution's authority come from? And the answer to that is the Declaration of Independence. And that was the founders' worldview statement, where they said specifically, they referred to the laws of nature and of nature's God, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And they said, truth is. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And so they said then the only purpose of government and the only limited authority that comes from God, and we see that in Romans 13, that that God ordained and established civil government for our protection. They referred directly to God's law to then say, we can then create and design a civil government that will go along with that specific mandate that it comes from God's authority. And so the Constitution actually has a source of authority. And if we go around that, if the Supreme Court ignores that, they're exercising illegitimate authority. And that's what no one talks about anymore. We have relegated the Declaration of Independence into this historical, antiquated, fascinating document that only has value as a history lesson. And that's not actually true. It's a legal document, and it creates the authority by which the U.S. Constitution gets its authority. So any interpretation of the Constitution absolutely must be consistent with biblical truth. And that's what my book is all about. The legal basis for a moral constitution is that we have to understand this isn't just my faith and my belief versus someone else's faith and belief. This is where is the legal authority for this. And if we go back and we look at our legal documents, there's a very clear and only legitimate legal argument for biblical morality, and anything else is absolutely illegitimate exercise of authority.
All right, now tell me the truth. Did you learn these things in law school?
Absolutely not.
And I suspected the answer was no. Where did you go to law school, if I could ask?
I went to the University of Richmond out in Virginia, which, by the way, is a great law school, and it was excellent. But in constitutional law class, they don't even start with reading the Constitution, and no law schools do, whether it was Richmond or somewhere else. You don't even read the Constitution. You start with judicial review and reading Supreme Court case decisions that simply assume that the court interpreted right. And so no, I didn't learn this. And that was my frustration in law school, because I grew up a Christian. I was homeschooled. I read Francis Schaeffer, read Nancy Piercy, read all of these really great biblical worldview authors.
Did you read John Eidsmo? John Eidsmo, The Christianity and the Constitution?
Yes, and all of those books that are so great. And then, so we know that our nation is founded on Christian principles, but then there's this huge divide. Then you go to law school and they say, oh, no, sorry, it's just whatever the whim of the judge that you happen to be before. They have ultimate discretion, and they can make a token reference to the Constitution, and that's what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And that was a really unsatisfying answer for me. So that's why I wrote the book, was to try to bridge that gap and say, no, this is the legal argument.
Yeah. And that's a very good point. What do you think about the phrase living constitution? Those who say, well, this constitution is a living, breathing document.
It's absolutely false, and that's also a legal fiction. For anything to actually mean something, for a written document to have any specific concrete, discernible meaning, it has to be objective. And the linguistics and the doctrine of originalism has those principles. And there are certain ways that we read every other written document. If I went into court arbitrating a contract and I said, well, judge, you know, this is a living, breathing document. My client might have said that he'd pay the other side $500, but what he really meant was $5. And we're going to just reinterpret that today because this is a living, breathing document.
Good for you.
I would get laughed out of the courtroom.
Yeah, good.
But that's what we're doing with the Constitution.
Boy, you are so correct. I mean, that is exactly what's happening. It's basically a thing of wax, to use a phrase from Thomas Jefferson, or has become a thing of wax in the hands of some of these liberal judges. Oh, okay, so we have half a minute left. How important is the battle over the Supreme Court in the upcoming presidential and senatorial elections?
Everyone should absolutely vote for the president and also all the way down ticket, even if you abstain, which I don't at all recommend. I think it's part of our civic duty and our obligation as Christians to be, we're entrusted with this country to vote. And I would say the best way to preserve the future of our country this election is to vote for Trump because of the Supreme Court, if that's the only voting issue. But even if your conscience does not allow you to do that, go and vote down ticket. My state is Colorado. We have a very contentious Senate election coming up that we all need to get out and vote for, and we need to vote for constitutional conservatives to make sure that we're influencing our government. And that's what we as citizens, that is our obligation. So absolutely vote. The Supreme Court is the number one issue.
JennaEllis.org. Jenna, thanks so much for being with us. God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Thank you now. Bye-bye.